to come up and join us. Up until recently, Father Gerasim was the abbot of St. Herman of Alaska Monastery in Platina, California, which is actually on the same road, or just off the same road as Manton. You go to the middle of Northern California on the freeway and to Highway 36, and you go west and you hit Platina, and you go east and you hit Manton. Father Gerasim is one of my oldest friends. We were in college together. I sponsored him when he was received into the Orthodox Church, and we had quite some adventures. Whether it was in college when we were going back and forth up to San Francisco to church, either I would be driving and he would be hanging out the window looking at the waves, or when he would be driving reading the Jordanville prayer book and I would really be praying. Highway 1, just south of San Francisco. Oh, Lord have mercy. Father Gerasim left UC Santa Cruz and joined St. Herman of Alaska Monastery, where he came under the close tutelage of Father Seraphim Rose. And after Father Seraphim's death, he remained at the monastery, although sent up to Alaska for quite a bit of time, and spent a huge amount of time there in Alaska on Spruce Island, and also going back and forth, running the life of the monastery and its various dependencies. And St. Herman of Alaska Monastery has been a very important monastic institution in the life of the Orthodox community in America. It became one of the largest Orthodox publishers, and was actually one of the first major Orthodox publishers with the publication of the Orthodox Word magazine, which is still being published now, 40 years later? Almost? 45? Wow. So, anyway, Father Gerasim is now studying at St. Vladimir's Seminary in preparation for future adventures in ministry. So it is it's a great joy. A great joy. Our two communities have been very close, there are many times when we would go back and forth across the valley. After all, it was only 75 miles to support one another on feast days and events. Their new abbot, Father Hilarion, spent, I believe, most of last summer crawling around the attic of Manton installing heating and air conditioning. Not something that they have at Platina. With that, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you. You're supposed to be this way. So I'm deeply grateful to Metropolitan Jonah for his love and patience, especially his patience over the years. And I must say that this is the first time I have been able to hear Archimandrite Meletius speak in public. That is to speak and actually address, I don't think I even heard him maybe once address the community in Manton. And so it's actually a real treat today to do this, to hear him. And I have many close friends who I've rarely heard them speak or act as a pastor, or, for example, the Metropolitan to function as a bishop, to actually see him do this. And when I do, it's a real joy and treat. And I give thanks to God for everything that took place in my life, especially even the circumstances that led up to Metropolitan Jonah and I, when he was then still Hiram Monk, working together more closely. It wasn't necessarily an ideal arrangement at that very moment, but I think that by God's providence, it turned out to be.
Does anyone have any questions that they would like to ask any of the panelists? Any ladies?
Yes, you mentioned there were two bases of vows, and I call one of the bases was community, and you had the other.
Thank you. Sorry, that was I may have missed it out. I know it worked from notes, so I sometimes get ahead of myself. The other dimension is the personal dimension, because every vow has an implication for the community as a whole, but each monastic has to go to each vow, and I would say with some frequency, to ask the question, what does this vow mean to me in my present situation? And I think it's a very real question, but I'm actually more interested in real answers. Because unless the monastic can answer those questions with some authenticity, then there is something lacking in their monastic life. You can belong to a brotherhood, which is wonderful, but your contribution to the brotherhood will depend on your personal commitment to the vows at a personal level.
That there are two vocations in life, marriage or monasticism, from our tradition's perspective. And we had a debate about that, actually, whether there wasn't a third one, which is sort of blessed, we could call it chastity or bachelorhood in the world, against which you alluded in your talk. I wonder if you could address that a little bit, especially given that if the history of our church, in at least in recent time, has been anti-monastic, then we also have a significant portion of the population of our church which has not benefited from the balance of monasticism and therefore thinks it's unnecessary for the 25 to 60-year-old bachelors that we must pastor. How do we do that?
Okay. Sure.
One of the hardest things I think we face in our society right now is that at any given point, 40% of adults are single. This is something unknown in history before. Because usually, up until the late 20th century, the only significant proportion of adults who would be single at any given time, other than widows, would be the monastics. Our society is also, I think, replete, and especially our urban areas, with people who are living alone. And then we have this horrific phenomenon of casting off our elders, putting mom and dad out in the retirement home where they can be happy without being disturbed by the children, without having to be a burden on our lives. This is evil. It's evil. In normal Christian life, there are two vocations. That of marriage, and that of monastic life. Everybody needs a family. Everybody needs a context. Everybody needs people around them with whom to share a lot relationships of love and intimacy and communion. And this, one of the great mistakes of our society is that we think that intimacy has and sex are necessarily related, but I can tell you that there is no necessary relationship between them, and I think we all know that sometimes sex can destroy intimacy. one of the, so it's within this context that I think we have to look at this question, because it's a new question that is being posed to the church. It's not a question that would have been posed 500 years ago or even 200 years ago, where there was not a great number of single people who were living lives in the world. I think there are ways in which we can see how a life in the world as a single person can be sanctified, but it is a very, very, very hard road. Because as St. Basil says when he addresses hermits, who is there to pick you up when you've fallen into despondency? Who is there to reassure you? Who is there to console you? It's interesting that St. Basil the Great, who himself was the main and the first giver of monastic rules, had no use for solitary ascetics. In fact, he wrote against it. And the great predominance of the communities to which he was writing were exactly active life monasteries, which were hospitals and hostels and homes for the poor and orphanages and had other very engaged, active social ministries. I think part of the problem is that in our society, monasticism has been so marginalized that we don't see it as a vital option for people to live out their lives. They have also, because monasticism and orthodoxy has become so reduced simply to a kind of, as Father Meletius said, a vaguely contemplative style, and these other forms are missing, it doesn't seem to be a viable option for many people. But yet monastic community, I think, is something that is critical. We look at the how many, for example, how many widows do we have in our parishes? I'm not talking about necessarily women whose husbands have just died, but those who have been left by divorce, those who were never married, those who had to flee abuse, all of these kinds of things. The widows were the first monastics in the New Testament. St. Paul talks about that. We're not doing anything for them. We're not even organizing them. And yet here is an incredible option for us to create a context for people to live out their lives, not in isolation and loneliness and abandonment and sorrow and despair, but in a context of love and support and community, directly in relationship to the rest of the life of the church. There are other groups of people within the life of the church too. And so that we need to look and to see what are the various options. And the monastic option doesn't necessarily mean that, a certain kind of clothing and a certain kind of diet and a certain kind of lifestyle. As it means that one's life is governed by vows, and those vows have a context in community. Even for a solitary elder living in a cave, his vows are in the context of a community, and his life is always in relationship to a community. So, does that answer? Yeah.
Father Meletios talked about, you don't have to answer this yourself, but he talked a lot about authenticity, or he used that word a lot. What do you mean by authentic? And that doesn't fit for any of you. What is an authentic person?
Go ahead, Nancy.
Tell yours. See, that's monastic obedience.
I think that is excellent emphasis that he's made. And authentic monastic is one, first of all, in the context of what Father Meletius has presented, who is living his life according to those vows in a way in which he is not only fulfilling them like a rule, but actually, as Abbot Dorotheus might say, making offerings. He's, in the context of those vows, making his life an offering to God. And he says this also in the context of St. Anthony the Great heard in the church. If thou will be perfect, go and sell all that thou hast. That is not said, that is not expected of every Christian. But for a monastic to fulfill his vows before God, as all of us are accountable before God to fulfill our baptismal vow, the offering of ourselves of faithfulness to God in baptism. So the monastic gives these vows in a way that is that doesn't limit him, but rather enables him to, by giving himself to God, to become creative, to be God's handiwork, and to, in that way, he can actually be a light to the world. Without giving himself fully in this way, he is really one who's somehow, his spirit is quenched in his life, and he has nothing to share, nothing to offer. And Father Meletius spoke at the very beginning of his talk of someone in whom the ego, in its very negative sense, is eradicated, that makes place for the activity of the Spirit of God within him. And that would be someone who is living in an authentic manner. It's authentically Christian. And to live in a Christian manner, first of all, does mean to be creative. That his prayer is creative. Doesn't mean he has to make up all sorts of words or gestures or unique ways of find all sorts of interesting prayers, but that his life becomes a prayer to God. And I think in that sense, his monastic life is authentic. It's not simply a copy. He's not mimicking something that he has seen or read, but his life, his monasticism comes alive. And if one lives in a monastic community and in the context of that monastic community is living an authentic monastic life, then there is room or a good context for doing precisely that activity which, as Metropolitan Jonah has just summarized, and as Father Meletius referred to when he mentioned stability, it may not mean being physically present in one place. It may not mean it certainly does not mean being obedient like a robot. Or by modeling his obedience after external military obedience. But as we see in the gospel, as we hear in the church fathers explain the gospel, by the Son becoming obedient to the Father, we are saved. And I think that carries a lot of strength. And our Christian faith is authentic because it represents the gospel. And it is inauthentic when it doesn't, when we're merely carrying out some sort of rule, or rule in the sense of following some sort of legalistic pattern. And we have a rule or a model or a measuring stick, some sort of confines in which we live our life, but that those confines are not our life. And we are, because we are vessels of the Holy Spirit, our life is to be characterized by that activity, the divine activity of God taking place in ourselves and in our life. And that's something that is truly alive. I think that also gives hope to the world around us. And I think that there's a little bit of something to think about when we talk about authenticity. And I think also that means a monastic life that is truly according to those vows, and not simply by wearing black robes. See, all of us have black robes and a beard. We have that. But we all, I know Metropolitan John would be the first one to say that that black robe does not make you a monastic. And in fact, you can be hiding a wolf. And that's a real danger. And so our monastic life has to be truly according to the intention of what those vows represent, and that we practice that interior life and not merely following some sort of rubrics.
You spoke about the dangers of denying your ego outside of the monastery. I know that I think it's Philippians where Paul wrote that we should have this attitude, the same attitude in us that was in Christ Jesus, that while he humbled himself, my version, and took upon himself humanity. He humbled himself, though he was equal with God. What danger is there in outside of the monastery that would require us to take a defense? You said we would need a defense. I think we're all called to be humble if we're Christians. We're all to have that attitude that was written for all of us, to take on that attitude. But I don't know what defense we would need. Could you speak to that a little more?
Yes. Did everybody hear the question? Okay. So, living without an ego and humility are not the same thing. Humility is something that we are called to do after the fashion of Christ, and that is, you're absolutely right. The theologians had a word for this, which in Greek is kenosis. It means emptying out, that God was able to empty himself out in order to become one of us in a very real way. The word ego doesn't really belong to New Testament terminology. It belongs to a world, another world. And I don't suppose you'll be here tomorrow morning, but I'm going to tomorrow try to explain what I mean by ego in that context, and it's basically to do with the vision which the Orthodox teachers have of the human personality, it's to do with our brokenness and what emerges from our brokenness. What emerges from our brokenness is essentially a stream of thoughts, which the fathers call the logismi. And this stream of thoughts is extremely deleterious to our social and spiritual development, and is in a sense the symptom of our brokenness. The disease itself is the fallenness of creation, of humanity. But the stream of thoughts is the symptom. These thoughts then coagulate to a certain extent and present us with an ego that we then have to defend to the rest of the world. The trouble with living in the world is that there are aspects of the ego which are in place to keep you safe. Now, Christ's words would imply to us that we have to take very seriously the possibility that if someone hits us there, that we allow them also to hit us here. But you know as well as I that that is not the world in which we're living yet. In fact, in the words of one Italian bumper sticker, it's summed up, "You touch my car, I smash your face." And that, in some senses, is the actual world within which we move. The fact that we have to be careful about people suing us in court or attacking us verbally because they don't like something about our way of life or whatever, generally means that we need some defenses in place. Otherwise, simply to lie down and let the world trample is the only option. By the time we get closer to the kingdom than we are now, and I have to say that the kingdom is very, very close, it will no longer be necessary to do that. But I do not believe that the layperson living in the world lives with as much freedom in that respect as the monastic living in community. And that was principally what I was trying to say. What you're saying is, in theory, absolutely correct. Humility is a difficult one. We all tend to have different meanings which we latch on to. But in the course of time, I think God will sort that one out too. So.
When you were speaking, you mentioned the term, of course, of a professor, but that a parish priest should not look at himself as a spiritual father. My parish family, because that's what I consider them, I love them all very, very much. And there's nothing I would do for them. And the reason, I don't know if I'm right or wrong, the context of what Christ said of loving one another, that's what I try to impress and teach them all the time. And in that respect, I feel I know that I'm responsible for them, for what I say, what I preach, and how I treat them. And that, to me, is what gives me a semblance of thinking that I am maybe a spiritual father in that respect. Am I wrong, or should I correct that, or what?
Well, certainly there are degrees of spiritual fatherhood. But one of the things I think it's very important for us to remember is that a spiritual father in a monastery is the head of a sacramental community. The monastery is a sacramental community. It's held together by the sacrament of obedience, the sacrament of the vows, mutual commitment to one another. What's the sacramental community in for people in a parish?
The body and blood of Christ. The body and liturgy. We need to get together.
Well, that's part of it. It's marriage. Marriage is the fundamental sacramental community for lay Christians. And this is very important. In a monastery, is like a big marriage. Oh boy! for lay Christians, one man marries one woman. Period. And the fruit of that is their children, and so the sacramental community expands. And so a parish is a community of communities. It's a community of families. And while the sacrament of obedience within a monastery is very clear of the monks to their spiritual father, and obedience does not mean control. Obedience means synergy or cooperation in love and respect. You have the same relationship in a family. Synergy, cooperation out of love and respect. And it's very important that the integrity of that relationship be supported by the parish priest as he ministers to each family. And I think this is the real, this really is the Orthodox model, because it's a ministry primarily to build up and to strengthen the families so that each family can live the life as a community. In a sense, each family is a mini monastery, just as each monastery is a family. And so there's a very great difference between the kind of obedience that a parish priest can require of the members of the parish and the obedience that an abbot can expect of his monks. So for example, if you have a parish priest and he starts thinking he's young Mr. Starets, and because he's a presbyter, that means he's an elder, that means he's a Starets, which means he's in delusion. And I am dead serious. I'm dead serious. And he starts telling you when you can have sex and how many children you can have and what color car you can buy and what brand of car you can buy and that you have to get a blessing before you can do this, that, or anything else, then run the other way as fast as you can. Because that is a community of delusion. And it's not Orthodox. And this is one of the things that we're addressing. And unfortunately, especially those of us who are converts. I think there's a few converts here in the room. especially coming from evangelicalism, where there was this very strong movement called shepherding. That has absolutely no place in a parish. Absolutely, categorically, and it's very. This is a very important point. But rather, what is the relationship then between the families in a parish? It's also a relationship of synergy, of cooperation, in love and respect, and that's guided by the priest. But the boundaries are much, much, much different than they are in a monastery. So what an abbot is a spiritual father in a monastery is not what a parish priest can be, although he truly is the father of his parish community. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Miriam.
Okay. Prior to becoming Orthodox, I had read some articles. My mother, her friends, made a lot of references between marriage and monasticism. It would seem to me that the four vows that you all take as monastics would apply perfectly to marriage. And I think that's what you've been saying here.
Well, okay, think about it. Poverty, chastity, obedience, stability. In a marriage, you enter into a community. Prenuptial agreements are no good. Okay? How is that a Christian marriage?
You couldn't trust somebody that.
Yeah, how can you trust? You couldn't trust somebody. It has to be a relationship where you completely give over all of your material goods to one another. You put it all in community, and you keep nothing back from the other. That it's everything is shared. That's the monastic sense of poverty. In other words, non-acquisitiveness. In other words, no selfishness. Chastity. We pray in the marriage service for a chaste marriage bed. That doesn't mean no sex. It means only the wife looks to her husband. The husband looks to his wife, and that is those are the boundaries of that chastity. And if you have anything else going on, there's going to be big problems. So chastity is a critical virtue in marriage. Obedience. Obedience as control, obedience as subordination is abuse. But obedience as synergy and love and respect is part of the very substance of the relationship. That love and respect, because how is there a relationship of communion without love and respect, which is obedience? And stability. You make your marriage is forever. It's not just, you know, or until somebody else comes along that I like better, you know, or who catches my interest. It provides a context of stability which is absolutely critical, not only for the psychological health of both partners, but for the psychological health of the children. You know, children are decimated by divorce. They're decimated. And anybody who's gone through a divorce is decimated. It's horrible. And so that stability of commitment, of relationship, of trust, of union, of communion, of love, is something that is lived out in a marriage, in the sacramental community of marriage as well. Just slightly differently defined. Both are types of communities. Both are sacramental communities consecrated by the Church, marriage and monasticism. The difference is marriage is between one man and one woman with the intention of bringing forth children, and monasticism is a community of men or a community of women with the intention of bringing forth spiritual children to the fulfillment of the kingdom.
Something about contrasting parish development here in the United States and in the old world. I wondered if you could elaborate on that a little bit and what you think, whether our parish development here should begin to look more like old world Orthodox countries or to be unique to see
in the United States specifically, but I think this goes in general for Orthodox communities in the Western world, the parish community has a identity often of some sort of emigre community. A parish hall where the social life of the parish is very important for that church or that parish to survive. And in a lot of the old world communities, that is not the case. They don't rely for their social needs or their identity upon that parish. They already have that identity. They have their social needs. And there, I think that it is not quite so critical to define themselves as Orthodox. And I think there are differences in the West that have made it very important for an Orthodox parish to survive or develop their life in that community. And I don't think that's the case at all in, for example, Eastern Europe. Father Miletius has a lot of experience with parishes in Greece, and I've seen some in some other places, and people come to church and go. Very few people would stay afterwards, for example, for coffee hour. And perhaps we have some strength in that respect here in the West. Perhaps our identity as Orthodox Christians has been emphasized more. And maybe that is also has a very positive side to it. But the I think there's less of a sense, for example, about a collection of money on some of the economic aspect of the church. And so there's some real differences. And I think for when Orthodox communities are far and few between, and when we have this division in the United States in different jurisdictions, it is... people are very, very cautious. For example, if someone goes to a monastery, how long did you spend there? What did you do there? Why did you go there? Etc. And I think in the old world, this would be very natural to visit an Orthodox monastery. Those monasteries also are often well established, some of them for 1,500 years. And that's not the case here. And in the old world, if you allow that expression, there are also clearly identifiable as part of the diocese or the patriarchate, per se. And so there is less worry or concern about where someone's going, what they've learned, what they did there, did they go to confession there? And so I think this is heightened here. Now, maybe Father Meletius, I missed the name, you maybe want to elaborate on this question.
Thank you. It's certainly true that nobody goes to church in Greece to prove that they're Greek. But that isn't necessarily a bad thing. Where it does become a bad thing is where the church, as the preacher of the gospel, is then aligned with certain nationalist interests. And if the nationalist interests outweigh the importance of the gospel, then we're in big and serious trouble. But let's face it, most of the churches, at least most of the churches until the last 20 or 25 years, were founded by emigre groups who simply wanted to bring their culture and their religion and everything here. And of course, because things here are not state-funded, then it was also necessary for the idea of the church being something into which everybody had to contribute in order for it to run. And in the early days, it was a question of bringing over a priest from the old country. And only later was there any sense of the authentic Orthodox ecclesiology of having bishops. Bishops were seen as something of an unnecessary addition in the earliest emigre days. Well, ecclesiologically, we know that that's very dangerous ground. The great thing is that God meets us where we are and not necessarily where we feel we ought to be. And so the situation in this country has not only certain aspects to it which are different from the old country, but also certain aspects to it which are in fact turn out to be strengths rather than weaknesses. To watch an ethnic community becoming an American community is sometimes difficult. You see a lot of pain and a lot of questioning. But nevertheless, that's the path that most of our parishes throughout this country are taking. And in Canada, they are also, but they're about 30 or 35 years behind. As I said earlier, that as we march towards American Orthodoxy, which is something which about which we have no choice at all, we just don't know when and how. As we march towards American Orthodoxy, then the best of everything that we are needs to be carried with us. And if, for example, membership in a parish gives a sense of collective responsibility for that parish, which is very difficult to define in Greece, who's responsible for such and such a church which has been there since the 5th century? It's an unthinkable question here. There, it's an everyday reality. Nobody's really responsible. And if various families stop supporting a particular place and let it fall into disuse, it falls into disuse. Here there's a sense of collective responsibility. But then our democracy also has a sense of collective responsibility, which the monarchical systems, which are basically the ones we left behind or our ancestors left behind in order to come to the United States in the first place, didn't allow. The participation of the people wasn't that important. Many things need to change as we move. But at least we have in this country the freedom to choose what we regard as the best of what we want to bring forward.
We've got about 15 minutes at least to the schedule. Okay, you already asked a question.
I asked half a question.
No.
At least in my experience with the OCA, I see a large convert community. So a lot of the historical is interesting as a spectator, but it isn't something I've lived. And I was interested in, you're talking about this balance between the parish and the monasteries. And I'm hoping you would talk a little more about, you're bringing somebody who is new and has never experienced a monastery, you know, what would you tell somebody, or what would you have the parish tell somebody who is new? How would you come to a monastery? What would the relationship between those be, and how do you establish that balance, as opposed to
okay.
resources or something?
One of the problems we face in Manton is that we have a lot of young men wanting to join. It's a terrible problem to have. But one of the problems I face as the person responsible is that sometimes I actually have to turn people away for various reasons. And one of the things that is most often a reason for turning people away is that they come to Orthodoxy and to monasticism simultaneously. And that usually does not bode well for their future monastic life or stability. I think there is an element of monasticism which is sort of heady and refined to a certain extent. There is another element which is earthy and extraordinarily incarnational, but that's not the end that I'm concentrating on right now. And we generally ask that people have at least 2 years' experience in a normal, large-ish parish before they come to a monastery. Because if they can't hack it in a parish, if you can't get through, if you can't survive parish life, then there is no way that you're going to survive the rigors of monastic life. Now, there may be exceptions to this, but the normative form of Christian life in Orthodoxy, in terms of numbers, is the parish. And that is where the baptisms take place. We don't baptize, well, except in very, very rare occasions. We don't marry people. We don't have regular families. It's in the parish that the fullness of social life is evident, which is not true in the monastery. We don't watch television. We don't have dances once a month. We don't. Apparently not. You know, at least that, if they have, they haven't invited me yet. So. Okay.
You're talking about the relationship as the lay people visit the monastery,
yes.
Not as come as monastics.
Okay.
Come on a weekend or however. What is their introduction? The folks that visit and leave again. The balance.
But we. I would have to say that again, authentic monasticism in the Orthodox context always implies hospitality. Do you remember? I'm wearing Texas. There's a convent in a place called Dunlap in California. And it's one of Father Ephraim's monasteries, and it's a monastery for women. And I was instrumental in doing all sorts of things when they were just starting up. And there was a very wonderful sister there. Her name was Fevronia. And she was about that tall and about that wide. And she had bright, bright red cheeks and a smile that could sink buses. And she was a delightful person. She's in Thassos, if you want to go visit her there in Greece. And... we were discussing, or she was discussing, a convent in Greece called Ormelia, which is really one of the finest women's monasteries in Greece at the present time. It was basically founded by the person who revived monastic life in Simonopetra on the Holy Mountain. These names may mean nothing to you, but don't worry about that. Anyway, Ormelia is a great monastery, and by any stretch of the imagination, is a very important monastic center. And Sister Fevronia told me that she was very disappointed with them, because on two or three days in the week, they shut the gates and they don't accept visitors. And for Sister Fevronia, this was a heresy, because monastic presence in Orthodox circles always involves hospitality. And monasteries without guests are hardly monasteries at all. So, not only are guests invited constantly, they are almost by definition required for the monastery to be what it claims to be. Lay people coming in, sharing the life, but not very far distant, that we don't have. In our setup, we don't have enclosures. You know, the monks live on this side of the bars and the lay people are on this side. We don't have anything like that. There are obviously private places within the monastery where guests are not generally invited to go. But nevertheless, guests stand next to us in church. They stand next to us where we eat our meals and so on. And live closely to us when they're at the monastery. And we certainly invite everyone and everyone, monastic or not, lay or not, Orthodox or not, to visit us. Because that's an essential part of our life. One thing, though, I think you may be getting at, although you didn't actually say so, is it's our job to put them at their ease, not their job to find out how to live without offending us. Because we do live in a pattern which is somewhat different from the outside world, and it's up to us to show them how to take part in that particular pattern. So, most monasteries would ask that, for example, people with shorts and bare arms wear something that covers their, covers them a bit better. Well, look at us. This is for 55 good reasons, and I don't need to go into any of them. But I would say that the way we approach a visitor who's wearing shorts and ask them to conform to our lifestyle and give them something to wear, so that they can. The way we do that is our responsibility. I mean, if somebody comes out of the blue and they happen to be wearing shorts, and they don't even know that, why would we worry about that? But for us, it may be a big deal. But you know, it's our neurosis, it mustn't be theirs. So we have to show them very gently, you're very, very welcome, but would you mind, just for the sake of, if you wouldn't mind just slipping this on or whatever, however you approach it, that's our job to make them feel at ease, even though we're asking them to do something which they think, which they don't recognize. Does that answer your question?
Some. I'm also wondering, what would the parish community tell their converts about monasticism to introduce it, and what would you suggest there?
That's very complicated. I think, what is the Orthodox method of evangelization? come and see. So when people bring people, I would say that would be the best introduction.
Have you? Have I missed you?
You didn't miss me.
How could I with that green cast?
Did anybody miss me?
Father Peter. First of all, brothers, please hear our thanks and gratitude for the three of you being here in our midst. I hope and pray this is appropriate, but I know for a fact that several of us, many of us clergy at least, consult one or several monks during the year in confession and solace and advice and so on. Rather than give a general description of that, please, if you would, comment on the fact that the appropriateness, propriety, the regularity of it. Is this something that is a normative for clergy to consult monastic brothers in monasteries on the sense of confession, on the sense of advice, on the sense of somehow or other sanity?
I like Father Peter's question. Okay, I'm going to turn it a little different direction. And I hope Presbyter Rebecca likes this. Very often, priests' wives come to the monastery. And as Father Miletius can tell you, he would tell you why. Because all priests' wives fear going to another priest for confession, because he probably went to seminary with her husband. And worse, they think that the other priest will tell his wife what she said in confession. And therefore they love to come to monasteries for confession, because they know that the higher monks and abbots don't have wives. It also, very often a priest's wife will be in a parish and she doesn't get away to go anywhere. And she doesn't confess to her own husband, so often they come to monasteries. Priests often go to monasteries and they even say, well, what do you do in such and such a case? Somebody came to me with this problem, or I feel really awkward. Also priests, except for a diocesan priests gathering, sometimes they don't have the opportunity to go to confession. And sometimes they go to a monastery. For example, you can go to a monastery in the middle of the week. And that's an opportunity. For example, go on a pilgrimage and have confession. And because a priest has a clear understanding, he's been in an Orthodox parish for more than 2 years, he knows that... He knows what to expect when he goes to a monastery. And he might even prefer to do that than to go to one of his brother priests with whom he went to seminary. And so I think actually it can be very positive, because the priests, even the higher monks and archimandrites and priests, also have this idea of their own brotherhood among the clergy, the ordained clergy. They bear a similar responsibility. They understand each other in that respect. They shoulder certain burdens in common. And therefore they can identify with each other. And in that sense it's very easy for a priest to go visit a monastery and actually find some solace. It's often a big burden off their back. And also they can go and participate in the full cycle of services without having to run out to the choir and tell the choir what to do. So that also is a big relief. And I think, and from my experience, it actually I found it to be a joy. And also, Father Miletius might not, but very often in the monastery, when a parish priest came to visit, I would ask them to serve. And even sometimes, I know this maybe isn't a common Orthodox practice in real Orthodox monasteries, but even to preach, like in the middle of the week. And actually good for the brothers to hear something that doesn't come from me or someone else. It comes from another priest who has pastoral responsibility and will share something from his experience as a priest that they might not hear otherwise. And so I think that, this interchange is very good for everyone. And I remember when Metropolitan Jonah was in Point Reyes, that a lot of priests used to go there. And they developed some very strong relationships with the clergy, all the clergy in the Bay Area. That was very good for everyone. It was a big support. And so I think does that answer what you were talking about? Okay. So that's how I would respond.
If I can expand on that just a little bit, it's also very good for lay people to go to monasteries for confession, you know, to have sometimes to find a spiritual father there. But one of the caveats is that I think it's an important thing to talk with your parish priest about it first, because there are some monasteries where there are where the priest might know something more about who the fathers are there than you might be able to discern from your own. Unfortunately, there are some monasteries that have kind of zealot tendencies, and if you go to them and you get a long, long, long penance, then that might be a burden very heavy to bear. So you have to, and something out of the norm for what one would receive in the Orthodox Church. That's unfortunately a reality, a pastoral reality that has been very difficult in many areas. Just because a place is a monastery, doesn't mean that you automatically can trust it, I'm afraid.
A question related with people from the parishes going to monasteries for advice, especially married. There are voices among clergy and among laity that monks don't know anything about family life. And how would you answer somebody that talks about that?
Well, yeah, you actually, as Father Gerasim said, you might be surprised. as we would say in the monastery, my brother is my wife. human relations are human relations. Now, if you want to, you don't go to, I wouldn't go to a monastery for marriage counseling or anything like that. And in fact, just because a priest has a Master of Divinity from St. Vladimir's or St. Tegan's or Holy Cross does not mean that they're a qualified marriage counselor. The priests that you go to, they have to know their limits, and you have to understand what their limits are too, and not ask of them something that is unrealistic. It's a very good thing, you know. You get a different perspective, perhaps, from a monk priest than you might from a married priest, maybe or maybe not. But remember that in a monastery, people are living in close community, like a family, and have to deal with a lot of similar kinds of situations. So...